The pallid sturgeon is kind of the picked-on kid of the Missouri River. His eyesight is bad, and he'll eat whatever happens to be available. Even the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service admits the pallid sturgeon might be, quote, one of the ugliest fish in North America. And he's been picked on almost to the point of extinction. Even though the pallid sturgeon is protected as a member of the endangered species list, he continues to be the focus of arguments. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we'll be taking you to the banks of the Missouri River to explore efforts to save the pallid sturgeon. We'll return to the studio to discuss the ecological health of the Missouri River and the ebb and flow of competing priorities along the Muddy Mo. That's coming up right after this news. Missouri River is many things to many people. For some, it's a scenic view and a place to enjoy recreation. Others think of it as a sacred wildlife habitat, home to fish and plants in need of a healthy ecosystem. For farmers, it represents both a source of irrigation and a looming threat of flood. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to kick off this conversation about the Muddy Mo by listening to a story about a fish that calls the Missouri River home, the flat-nosed pallid sturgeon. KCUR's Suzanne Hogan has the story about this endangered fish that's been living in the river for more than 70 million years.
The pallid sturgeon has been living in the Missouri River since, well, the Missouri River first formed. They have very small eyes, grow up to 6 feet long, and can live to be over 50 years old. They have no bones. They're completely made of cartilage, like sharks and rays. And though those are all fun little facts, it doesn't make the pallid sturgeon what you would call the most charismatic endangered species.
There's no pallid sturgeon fan club.
And they're ugly.
The males and females can actually see each other now, and that could be their problem. Some people speculate that that's why it's endangered, is because who would want to breed with that?
Neil Bass, yes, Bass, has been fishing since he could hold a pole. He's a biologist working on the Missouri River for the Army Corps of Engineers. And pallid sturgeon jokes aside, Bass says changes to the river have been hard on the pallid.
You know, people call the Missouri River the Big Muddy, but it's not near as muddy as it once was.
In fact, the river has 80% less sediment than it once did due to dikes, lakes, and embankments. The river moves faster, it's deeper and narrower than it used to be. It's just a different place than the pallid once knew.
The Corps actually modified the river to make it better for people, for navigation, to make it habitable on the shores of the Missouri, and we're never going to move away from that.
So if the river is never going to go back to its natural course or be what it once was, is it possible for this dinosaur to survive here anymore? The Corps, which spends $1 million annually on pallid sturgeon recovery efforts, thinks so.
I believe it's important for us to try and save the species, especially one that we have pushed towards the brink of extinction.
That's why Bass and I and a few others are on a boat on the Missouri River about 20 miles east of Liberty. And it's raining a lot. We're looking for a large, wild, female pallid sturgeon that has never been used before for breeding. They do this collection every year, the last 2 weeks of March and first two of April.
The rain wouldn't stop us.
Kyle Winders is driving the boat to all the worm-baited trot lines set out to attract the fish. He's an ecologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation, one of the many agencies that's working with the Corps to save the pallid. When the pallid sturgeon was listed in 1990, their numbers were so low that the Fish and Wildlife Service approved stocking, breeding wild pallids at hatcheries to put them back into the river. Female pallids take 15 to 20 years to reach sexual maturity, so finding just the right fish is a challenge.
Needle in a haystack.
And we're pulling in all kinds of fish. Catfish, chubs, shovel-nose sturgeon. They weigh and measure every fish caught for research purposes.
742. 599.
The information is entered into a database, and then they throw the fish back in. But it gets a little more complicated once a pallid is caught.
Another one.
Another pallid?
They get a lot of extra care. Everything is measured. Water velocity, the turbidity, that's the clarity of the water. And if it's a hatchery fish, which most are, it's been implanted with a tag that's full of information. Winder's partner, Thomas Huffman, scans this pallet in his hand, which I don't think is all that ugly.
And then we get the number, and we can look up that fish right there in our database, and we'll know exactly where we caught him, how many times we've caught him, how much he's grown, all the info we need to know about him.
Even the fish's mother and father, their brother and sisters, hatcheries are using this data to create a genetic matrix to avoid inbreeding and to track the species' development.
There was a lot of concern initially about the pallid sturgeon and its survivability in the Missouri River.
Neil Bass again.
And we know now that adult sturgeon and even like sturgeon older than 1 year actually do really well in the river.
829,000 pallid sturgeons of various sizes have been stocked in the Missouri River since 1992. Though data shows pallids from 0 to 1 year old still have a hard time surviving, Bass says they know that numbers from boat ride collections like these have been increasing over the years.
Just with the stocking efforts alone and the long-livedness of the species, my grandchildren will be able to see a pallid sturgeon.
This boat's numbers, only a week in, have already collected 40 pallids for propagation, which was this boat's season total for last year. Bass sees it as a sign that the efforts are gaining traction and hopes life for this Missouri River bottom feeder might be starting to look up. Suzanne Hogan, KCUR News.
That was KCUR's Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman, here to talk more about the Missouri River, home to the pallid sturgeon, with a few visiting experts. First, I've got Darby Neiswanger here from the Missouri Department of Conservation, where she works as resource staff scientist. Good morning, Darby.
Good morning.
Do you ever make it out on the Missouri River hearing those sounds that Suzanne brought back, those nice plunks into water?
Oh, yeah, that's what I do on a daily basis is fish the river. So that's what I tell people, and they get pretty jealous usually when I tell them I'm going to go fish for a living.
Yeah, gone fishing.
Mm-hmm.
We also have two guests from the Army Corps of Engineers. Lori Farmer and Zach White are with the Army Corps of Engineers Missouri River Recovery Program. Hi, guys.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Lori, what is the Missouri River Recovery Program?
The Recovery Program is an effort that the Army Corps takes on to it's a multifaceted approach where we try to implement habitat back on the river system for the pallid sturgeon, but it also tries to assist two other species that are noted as threatened and endangered, including the two bird species, the piping plover and the interior least tern.
And Zach, what are the chances that this fish that we've been exploring, the pallid sturgeon, will return to being a self-sustaining, repopulating species? Will we always be breeding them to keep them alive?
Well, that's the intent of the Missouri River Recovery Program, is to provide a self-sustaining population. So that's our goal, and our time frame is by 2024.
It might sound crass, but does everyone agree that preserving the pallid sturgeon is inherently important? I mean, far be it from me to question the validity and right of any species to live. I'm as sensitive to that as anyone else. But I wonder if there's a consequence to these preservation efforts that could make someone think twice about whether the survival of that species is worth the overall fallout.
Yeah, I think the whenever one species is in danger, sometimes it could act as an indicator species that the overall health of the river is not what it should be. And so if one species is struggling, that could be an indicator that many others are too.
And what about that? Darby, you were kind of nodding your head. What about the overall health of the river? Is that just inseparably tied to the health of the pallid sturgeon?
Well, I think if you look at the health of all fish species in the river as a whole, so what we do as an agency, the Department of Conservation, we sample fish in the river all year round. And so in recent years, we've seen that the population of many native river species are relatively stable. However, that is from they have declined in the past due to the alterations of the habitat in the river. So we'd like to bring them back up to what they once were in the past. And that includes the pallid sturgeon as well.
I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to Central Standard. We're talking today with Darby Neiswanger from the Missouri Department of Conservation and Lori Farmer and Zach White from the Army Corps of Engineers Missouri River Recovery Program. And we are talking about the ecological well-being of the Missouri River. I'd like to look at the history of that subject a little bit. How has the Missouri River changed over time, Lori?
Yeah, I'd be happy to answer that. Throughout the course of time, after Lewis and Clark's exploration, There has been quite a few substantial changes on this river system itself. Starting as early as the late 1800s, the Army Corps was starting to implement things like dikes and wing dams on the river system to help facilitate navigation and the movement of goods up the system. And this was in support of westward expansion. This was in support of the movement of goods and trying to explore the western areas. So you could see through some of our projects, through the Bank Stabilization and Navigation Project that started in the early 1900s, we started putting in a lot of wing dikes and wing dams along the system. And what that did in the lower portion of the river, specifically the lower 735 miles from Sioux City, Iowa, down to its confluence with the St. Louis, is we were trying to make a system that allowed for easier passage and easier movement of goods, a more confined channel. And we did it very well. Actually, the Army Corps did that very well. It went from more of a braided system with other features like sandbars and islands and multiple side channels and backwater areas into more of a confined system. And that is, some of the morphological features that we were seeing on the lower part of the system.
What's the purpose of confining the river?
Okay, so creating more of a confined channel and more of a deeper channel does help with, we are mandated to maintain a 9-foot channel for navigation traffic to move through. So that is the purpose of that, to keep opportunity available for navigation and barge traffic to move up the river system. So that is the purpose of that. And then concurrently, or later on, about in the mid-1940s, 1944, we also implemented a series of reservoirs in the upper system. There's six, main stem reservoirs that are pretty significant in size, actually some of the largest in the United States. And those were there and provided to help with multiple benefits. Actually, there's 8 authorized purposes on the Missouri River. And
8 authorized purposes for the Army Corps of Engineers.
For the Army Corps of Engineers, thank you, yeah. That came through the 1944 Flood Control Act. And through the implementation of these 6 reservoirs in the upper portion of the system, these 8 authorized purposes, I'm going to try to list them off really quick, such as flood control, navigation, hydropower, water quality, water supply, irrigation, fish and wildlife, and...
Well, I'm going to jump in. We'll get back to these purposes in just a moment. But it's interesting because, I think back to the book and movie title, A River Runs Through It. That sounds so simple, but it sounds like the river doesn't just run through it. A lot of human beings intervene a lot in the river and manage the river and shape the river. And have attitudes about to what extent, Darby, and I'd like you to answer this, to what extent humans should intervene and to what end? Have attitudes toward that subject changed over time?
Well, I would expect that it depends on your relationship to the river. So if you live on the river, you probably would want it to be managed for flood control, or maybe if you're a farmer on the river, you would want it to be managed for flood control. If you're a recreator on the river, you would want it to be managed with maybe stable flows so that, you can have a predictable, weekend flow so you can go out on the river. I don't know if it's changed over time, but as the rivers change, I would expect that people's attitudes have changed about the river for sure.
And Mark Twain has this famous quote about the Missouri River being too thick to drink and too thin to plow. So muddiness is an important factor in the Missouri River. Muddiness, that's all about sediment, right, Zach?
That's correct. The main stem reservoir system, which Lori talked about, it choked off the sediment load from the upstream part of the river. And so the Missouri River is about 2,600 miles long, and only about 735 miles, the lower river, exist without, there are significantly modified by having that choke point of those upstream dams. And so we're actually having major problems in some areas of the river with degradation, which is where the river lowers out. The bottom of the river drops out and it can impact private infrastructure.
What is the significance of sediment to the river more broadly and to the species that live on the river?
Well, the significance of sediment in the river is that the river wants to carry a certain amount of sediment. And if the sediment isn't there, then it's going to take sediment from somewhere else that it can get it from. And that could be from the bed or from the banks. And that's kind of the problem that we're facing here is the main stem reservoirs have choked off that sediment and the river is taking it from the riverbed.
So, Lori, you were talking about these eight purposes for which the Corps of Engineers intervenes in the river. And how do you manage all of those different interests, economic, ecological, recreational, all sorts of interests? How do you manage those, especially in cases where they come into conflict with one another?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that is, you know, one of the things that the Army Corps of Engineers really, you know, tries to balance out whenever we do any project on the river. And in particular, with this Missouri Recovery Program, you know, anytime that we go through any planning project on the river, we do consider those other seven authorized purposes. And we, you know, through our planning efforts, we do try to balance out and consider those. We specifically really try to balance out flood risk management and navigation and make sure that any of our projects and programs do not have a negative effect or impact on those other authorized purposes.
But does that sometimes happen that there is a negative impact on one group that results from you trying to act on behalf of another?
Well, as we go through the planning process, our projects, we try to carefully plan and not have a negative impact on those. And we do have a lot of opportunity for public input into those on the front end of a project as well as on the back end of a project, too.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm here today with Darby Neiswanger, Lori Farmer, and Zach White. We're here talking about the ecological health of the Missouri River, and we've got a lot to fit in this segment, so let's get right to it. Lori, I want you to explain, you're here from the Missouri River Recovery Program. Can you explain what that is? I understand the purpose is essentially to bring the river back to a more, quote-unquote, natural state.
Yeah, we talked earlier about some of the habitats that were lost through the Bank Stabilization Navigation Project. And overall, the Corps estimates that about 522,000 acres of fish and wildlife habitat and aquatic habitat had been lost along the main stem Missouri River in the lower portion, the lower portion being about 735 miles from Sioux City to St. Louis. So in the 80s, in about 1986 and 1999, they started the mitigation project where we could replace some of those habitats that were lost, 167,000 acres. That, in combination with our work with the Fish and Wildlife Service through a biological opinion that we're mandated to implement, we are trying to recover habitats for the pallid sturgeon, interior least tern, and piping plover.
Okay, and Zach, tell me, I am really interested in this issue of what is a natural habitat? What is a natural flow of a river? After centuries of human intervention, or in this case, probably more like a century of human intervention, what does that mean? And is human intervention part of nature?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I don't want to be the naysayer here, but I'm not sure if we'll ever see the Missouri River be a natural river again. And that's not what the Corps' mission is. In the last 100 years, Congress has invested $35 billion in the Missouri River through some of our projects. And that investment generates about $1.8 billion every year. There's too many people who live in the Missouri and depend on the Missouri River as well for us to see it go back to a natural state. So what the Corps does is that we build projects for endangered species, and those projects allow us to continue to operate and maintain the river to be able to achieve that $1.8 billion in benefits every year.
One of the aspects of a natural river is rivers naturally flood. Can you talk about the complications of flooding as part of a natural river behavior?
Yeah, flooding is a very complicated issue. It depends on the amount of rainfall and the location of the rainfall, and a lot of times it depends on whether that rainfall is upstream of one of our reservoirs. One of the Corps' primary missions is flood control, and you know, if the rainfall event occurs downstream of our reservoirs, we can't do much about it, and then the river would function more as it would have historically. But the Corps is in the business of flood control, and so we do our best. We make our best effort every year to prevent that from happening, and that does have an unnatural effect on the river. But that's not the Corps' mission, is to make it a natural river.
There's an active lawsuit involving farmers whose land has flooded, sort of contending that the Corps' behaviors that are acting in the interest of wildlife preservation have contributed to that.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is currently under litigation, and it's the Corps' policy not to comment on pending litigation.
Of course, that makes sense. And Darby Neiswanger, what would be your interpretation of the natural state of a river and whether that's achievable and what the importance of it being in a natural state would be?
I think that a natural state we would look at as the Department of Conservation, you know, stable populations of the wildlife and the fish and the organisms that call a river home, whether it be birds or amphibians or insects or fish. And we talk about the pallid sturgeon being an indicator species a lot. And to indicate maybe that the river is stable, we would see that maybe the pallid sturgeon is maintaining a stable population and they are reproducing in the river and their little babies are surviving to adulthood so they can reproduce themselves. We would love to see that, and as the Department of Conservation, we continue to monitor all the organisms that live along the river.
So fish are kind of like the obvious water dwellers, but there are other life forms that have relationships with this river. I hear that the Missouri River ecosystem is a significant pathway for migratory birds, is it not?
Yes, it is.
That might be kind of counterintuitive for some people, like birds are up there flying, and we don't think of them as having relationships to rivers necessarily. What is that relationship?
So we see a lot of the migratory paths of birds, of waterfowl specifically, following those river corridors, whether it be the Missouri River or the Mississippi River. And we see the waterfowl using the wetlands along the river, whether they be you know, flooded wetlands, man-flooded wetlands, or natural wetlands, and they use those as stopping grounds for their migrations north or south to rest and feed, and they're very important feeding grounds. Those wetlands and the river itself is important feeding grounds for waterfowl and other shorebird species.
How are those bird species doing that rely on this ecosystem to survive?
I think overall, you know, most of the waterfowl species are stable. They do, it depends on, you know, counts that they do and the nesting grounds in the northern part of the country or even Canada. And they use those counts to determine waterfowl harvest numbers. And overall, in the last several years, those harvest numbers have been relatively stable.
Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm joined by phone in this segment by Steve Schnarr of the Missouri River Relief Group based in Columbia, Missouri. How's it going, Steve?
It's great. Thank you so much.
So you organize cleanup activities along the Missouri River, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We've been working on this for 14 years. And we organize thousands of volunteers and communities up and down the Missouri River to get out on the river and pick up tons and tons of garbage that has been washed into the river, mostly from our city streets and storm drains.
What kind of stuff do you find in there?
Absolutely everything. Anything that floats. You know, if it floats, it's going to make it downstream. We were actually in Kansas City this weekend working on the Missouri River as part of the Project Blue River Rescue, which is an amazing volunteer cleanup event on the Blue River. So we decided to clean up trash on the Missouri that had probably washed in from the Blue River. And I'll tell you what we mainly found was plastic bottles, little bits of styrofoam, and an amazing number of balls. I think we probably ended
like
up
toy
with,
balls, or
yeah, anything from golf balls, tennis balls, baseballs. We didn't find any bowling balls this time, but they happen occasionally.
Weird.
So, believe it or not, they float. Barely, but they do.
And I've read some of the logs about things that you found. I'm interested in the number of refrigerators and refrigerator parts.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, one of the things that we notice is anything that costs people money to dispose of or is a little difficult to dispose of, we find this stuff in the river. And people are dumping them maybe in the creek in their backyard or just some deserted road and it ends up down in a stream that washes into the river. You know, it's a little interesting because you can actually get money for refrigerators. It's got metal in it. That has value. But if you're, you know, hoping to just get rid of it on your curb, that will cost you money. So then we end up finding these things in the river.
So how do you get these things out of the river? I mean, it sounds kind of simple. We go and collect trash. But, I mean, objects ranging from little pieces of styrofoam to refrigerators?
Yeah, well, most of what we do is dropping volunteers along the banks of the river. I mean, the Missouri River is a volatile river. The river levels may vary as much as 25 feet during a month, comes up and down. And when it does that, it's sort of pushing trash from upstream out into the floodplain and along the banks. And that's where we've put a lot of our effort into cleaning that kind of stuff that's been deposited on the banks. Now, you know, the Missouri River, it's swift, it's muddy. It's not like we can scuba dive down there and get stuff off the bottom, so we don't
even
worry about
that.
That
does not sound pleasant.
No, I don't think that would be good. So we do put effort into, you know, trying to clean up the stuff that's floating along the banks, but most of our volunteers, you know, the safest thing is just to get that stuff that's washed up on shore.
I'm looking at some pictures from one of your cleanups, and I see tons of pieces of scrap metal and tons of tires. Do tires fall into that same category as things that are hard to dispose of?
Yeah, they cost money to dispose of. So, and it's just kind of a pain in the butt. You've got to, you know, stick them in a truck and take them to a place, and then you may be paying anywhere from $2 to $20 to get rid of them. So people don't take care of them. Floods come, they wash them into the river, all kinds of stuff.
So Steve Schnarr of the Missouri River Relief Group, you spend a lot of time on the Missouri River. You know it intimately. And I wonder, is it a river that you would choose to spend time in and around recreationally?
Oh, yeah, that's the only reason why I'm doing this. I love the river. I go canoeing on it a lot. I love to spend time by the river. I don't think most people here realize what a world-class amazing resource we have here. And that's really why our organization and a bunch of our partners, you know, all over the place have started. Our whole goal really is to give people an opportunity and access to get on the river and kind of realize like wow, this is a big deal running through our city here. And we hope that through river cleanups, you know, people sort of get a sense of ownership of the river and a sense of pride and even identity, you know, that, you know, someday we hope that Kansas City brags on being a Missouri River town. You know, that's like our goal. I mean, I want to add another thing related to the conversation you've been having.
Yeah, please.
You know, this weekend we were on the river near Sugar Creek, you know, a little downstream of Kansas City, and there's an area there where there is a habitat project that the Corps of Engineers has been working on to create different kinds of habitat that basically got removed from the river. We call it the 350 bar because it's right around mile 350 on the river. As we were working that part of the river this weekend, that is where all the wildlife was. It was along these new sandbars in these little side channels. There were hundreds of white pelicans and hundreds of seagulls that were hanging out there.
Darby Neiswanger of the Missouri Department of Conservation, does that surprise you?
Not at all. No, that's definitely what we see. anytime you have an exposed sandbar, you see birds on it. And, you know, like I said, like Steve said, we've been seeing a lot of pelicans lately, which is really neat to see. And I don't know if a lot of people realize that we have these huge pelicans that migrate through our state, and you see them all right along the Missouri River, as well as the amazing amount of bald eagles we've seen this year along the river. It's been incredible.
And Steve, I want to ask you a question, because you were talking about, you know, wanting to Kansas City to have pride in its riverfront location. What is your sense of how the Missouri River's cleanliness compares to the cleanliness and viability of other rivers in the United States?
Well, the Missouri River certainly has its issues, but if you talk to people that are in the drinking water field, providing drinking water for cities and municipalities, overwhelmingly, they mentioned the Missouri River is actually being a high-quality water source. Since the Clean Water Act, a lot of the real troubling inputs into the river have been decreased. I mean, and if you go back before that, you know, Kansas City had this, in the West Bottoms, these amazing slaughterhouses that basically dumped all their stuff in the river.
Wow.
And that's developed this reputation that the river is like a sewer, and it does receive a lot of stormwater, you know, sewer discharge. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Well, we've got to get out here in a second, and I want to give Lori Farmer from the Army Corps of Engineers a chance to tell us about what her thoughts are about the potential of the Missouri River for recreation.
Yeah, I did want to make one final point in regards to the recovery program, that when we do these habitat projects, they are public lands available, and we co-manage them with a lot of state agencies. So there's a lot of opportunity for hunting and fishing on these project sites.
All right. Well, this has been an enlightening conversation with our guests from the Army Corps of Engineers and the Missouri Department of Conservation, as well as Steve Schnarr of the Missouri River Relief Group. Thanks so much for being here today, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.